Psychologie fürs Klassenzimmer. Forschung zu Schule und Unterricht, die jede Lehrerin und jeder Lehrer kennen sollte. Ein Podcast mit Benedikt Wisniewski.
Hallo und herzlich willkommen. Nach längerer Unterbrechung melde ich mich zurück mit dem Podcast Psychologie fürs Klassenzimmer. Heute mit einer Spezialausgabe, in der ich mit John Hattie über ein Thema spreche, das aus meiner Sicht in den nächsten Jahren in der Schullandschaft ein sehr wesentliches sein wird. Es geht um das Thema der Deimplementierung und ich wünsche Ihnen viel Spaß. A very warm welcome to John Hattie. I really appreciate you taking the time again to have this conversation with me.
It's a pleasure to talk to you, Ben.
I think you're someone who doesn't need any introduction, so let's start right away. We have had a topic that both interests us before, namely feedback. And now we have another topic, another common topic, and it's called deimplementation. In Germany, many people may not yet know what this exactly means. So how would you explain the concept to somebody who has never heard of it?
Sure, Ben. We all know about implementation, and we all have experienced so many different policies that come into a school, that a school invents itself. Teachers are incredibly busy. They live in the present. We never have enough time. And so we're looking at the opposite of that. What do we stop? What do we stop doing that is not effective, that is not efficient? Because we can't just keep adding things to the teacher's plates. We can't just keep piling on more and more and more. And I think there's another dilemma, Ben, that makes the topic really, really topical. And that during COVID, we experienced a totally different concept of how we used our time. And it's interesting that teachers, like nurses, are probably the only profession that's come back and just picked up where they were before COVID. And many of them are saying, I don't want to do that anymore. And so I think we need to seriously look at how do we stop doing some things to create the time to allow the other more productive things to do. And I have to tell you, it's one of the hardest things to do in the business is to get teachers to de-implement. And we call it de-implementation because what we've found is it's not as simple as stopping. If you've been doing the same thing for 20 years in your career, Ben, it's very hard to stop. In the same way, it's very hard to stop smoking, to stop lots of things. So we look at it in terms of, can we re-engineer it? Can we replace it? Can we reuse it? Or can we come up with other ways of looking at ways in which we can de-implement what's happening? So the fundamental notion is, how do we look at removing some of the things we do to create space?
Yeah, and of course, creating space always means getting rid of certain things. And therefore, I very much like the definition from the medical field of de-implementation, where the term is defined as getting rid of low-value practice. I think this term is quite an important one. And I think what teachers have to do every day is full of low-value practice. And starting from there, the most important question certainly is, why do we have to de-implement things?
Because we can't just keep adding. We can't expect the profession to cope with all the things that we push on them. Now, I want to be very clear here, Ben. When we do the time and motion studies, for example, of school leaders, about 4 to 8% of the tasks they do are compliance from above. Same with teachers. Most of the work we do is self-initiated. We have chosen to do that work. Not all of it, but most of it. And that's why it's very, very hard to do, but why we have to seriously look at it. Because, like you quoted from the medicine, I would say that anything that has low impact, because we know from the research, and I've done this in the visible learning work, that 95% of things that we do to students raises achievement. So every teacher will have evidence that what they do improves students' learning. It's such a low threshold. And if you want, as I want to do, raise the bar and say, we can truly make a difference to kids' learning, all students can gain at least a year's growth for a year's input, then we have to look at what we're doing to create the time and space to do the things that really matter and minimize the things that don't matter so much. Let me give you an example. Some teachers spend a lot of time making their walls beautiful, and they change them every 6 or 8 weeks. And I ask those, and there's nothing wrong with that. I'm not saying anything wrong with that. But what I'm asking those teachers to do is one time take their students into another room and ask them to note what was on the wall. Most of them haven't a clue. They don't look at it. It's like paintings in your house. They're nice, they're pleasant, but they're not going to change much. And so I know this is a trivial example, but there are many, many of those kind of examples that take away from teachers' time that actually have no impact on student learning. And when we looked at the nature of them, like we picked up in the book around 90 to 100 things like putting stuff up on the wall, that if you removed it, you could actually come up with an appreciable amount of time saving.
You just said your goal is to raise the bar. And what I find quite interesting is that raising the bar is often, and especially in the school system, seen as equivalent to adding things. And I love the seminal paper by Gabrielle Adams and colleagues from 2021. It's actually the study that made me get involved in the topic. And this paper is called Why People Systematically Overlook Subtractive Changes. And what they found out was that when people have to solve problems, then they usually tend to add components to the situation, even if there is a better solution by removing things. And to me, this is quite eye-opening because it seems to be a natural tendency to add things in order to raise the bar, as you said it. And so I think it's quite difficult to make people understand that there's sometimes an equally good or even better solution that comes from removing or reducing. So the slogan, less is more, is simply a wonderful one, isn't it?
You're right. And there's a risk, Ben. If I stop doing something that I've been doing a long time, there's a risk that things won't work as I know it. And so there's a safety in that. And there's also that sense of, oh, this is a new idea, I will try it, with no consideration of what you don't do. It's kind of like, and you've been a graduate student, Ben, I've been a graduate student, we deal with graduate students, we deal with teachers, and they say, I don't have the time. And I want to look you in the eye and say, yes, you have the same time I have. It's priorities, not time. And that's another way of looking at de-implementation, is how would you prioritize your time? But many educators work in the moment. They're very present at the moment. They deal with what's happening right now. And as a consequence, what's in the moment becomes important. And they don't ask the priority question other than, I'm going to deal with it now. Well, that sometimes is not the most productive. And so you're right about, and Adams is right about why we don't tend to look at not doing things. But again, we can't just keep adding things.
Well, and of course, there is also a risk in adding things. Because if you look, for example, at the OECD PISA data, the results of the 15-year-olds in Germany have become worse and worse since 2013. And at the same time, you look at teacher mental health statistics, and you see that the mental health deteriorated vastly during the last 8 or 10 years or so. So there's a risk as well, because by adding more and more things, stress increases without any measurable benefits for students.
There's a real quandary here. And that I mentioned before COVID. And when I look at teacher workload, and I'm mainly looking at my Australian context, I can't see any difference in the workload post-COVID compared to pre-COVID. But as you said, the debate about burnout, attrition, leaving schools, attracting people in the profession has become much more serious since COVID. Really, really serious issues. And so part of me says the problem is not workload. And so when I search for ideas, and the hypothesis I'm exploring at the moment is that during COVID, when you were teaching from home, it wasn't as relentless. You could actually turn your Zoom off for a while the students did things. You could go and have a coffee, you could walk the dog, you could put the washing on. Whereas at school, you used every minute working with those students. When you walked to the staff room, you talked about education. When you did playground duty, it was with the students. There's no sense of time to stop and pause. And my hypothesis is that since COVID, teachers are saying, I don't want the relentlessness. And this is, again, where de-implementation becomes very critical. How do we actually create space during the day for teachers to pause and have that conversation with themselves or with others about priorities, about why they're doing this rather than that? And I go to, for example, I look at what's happening in Singapore at the moment. Since COVID, by law, every second Friday, the students are not with their teachers. They're in COVID mode. They're at school, but they're with the teaching aides, with other people who are monitoring them, and they have to work alone. And the teachers, in that sense, have a four-day class work week. Now, it was hard to set up because many teachers and students loved performing in front of the class. It's easier. You've got more control. So it took a while for teachers to teach kids how to work in groups and how to work alone, but it's been a roaring success. And I think the biggest travesty of COVID is that we learned nothing. We've rushed back to the old model. So I'm looking very closely at this attrition problem we have at the moment, an attraction problem, and saying we've got to make sure that we have the right problem on the table. The problem is not workload. The problem is relentlessness. And that's why de-implementation becomes even more critical. We've got to give teachers the time to stop and think about priorities. Like, I can't come into your class, Ben, and say, I want you to stop doing this, 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 and this, because you won't. But I have to give you time and space. I have to give you the resources. I have to give you the opportunity of discussion and debate with others. And if you're a school leader, similarly, what do I, as I said, not necessarily stop, what do I remove? What do I reduce? What do I re-engineer? And what do I replace? And we must have those discussions and we must create time. So my point being is that our current situation, we have to really understand why we're in this current situation and not just presume we've got the right problem in the table. I don't think the problem is workload. I think the problem is relentlessness. I know that every time I take 10 things off a teacher or a teacher takes 10 things off themselves, they replace it with 10. Now, that's not necessarily bad, but it's not solving the problem.
I would like to get back to this later, why people add 10 things when you take 10 things away from them. But before that, what really interests me is if you could choose a number one practice that needs to be de-implemented in schools, what is the first thing to get rid of?
I don't think teachers have to spend as much time on grading and marking and commenting, particularly with artificial intelligence coming in so strong. We have also many schools, certainly in Australia, I don't know about Germany, have teaching aides, paraprofessionals, who could do a lot of that grading and marking and have much more of a higher effect than they do in many cases at the moment. And so I think that's one area where we could do it. With if you put a rubric and really set your AI up correctly, you can get some really good comments. And the studies we have been doing, the students actually prefer the comments from the computer because it doesn't do all the, oh, Ben, you're the naughty child, you're the whatever. The computer doesn't know that. It focuses on your work. And it also focuses much more than humans do on improvement because you tell it that. I want feedback that helps improvement. Now, if anybody should know, given your own PhD, that improvement feedback is the most powerful. It's probably not as common amongst humans as it is amongst computers. So I think that's one area which you could save an incredible amount of time that teachers do, often not in the classroom, but in their social time, that we could look at. The other thing is with grading and commenting, at the end of doing it all, if you can't answer this question, I think you've wasted everyone's time. What did I learn about what I taught well, who I taught well, and how big was my impact?
That's interesting because I would have named the same thing. To be precise, marking errors in work assignments. This consumes millions of working hours. It is experienced as one of the most stressful and unpleasant tasks by teachers. And it has zero impact on student achievement. In Germany, teachers spend millions of hours correcting mistakes every year. Millions. And we have done some research on corrective feedback together. You know, the results were mixed, but when you look at the data in detail, you see that marking errors and providing alternatives to wrong solutions have absolutely no impact on achievement or learning. And John Truscott, in his 2007 meta-analysis, found out that students can't use corrections as useful feedback. It's as simple as that. It's helpful to provide comments, like, for example, check the coherence in paragraph 3, or check your spelling in this passage, or whatever, and then let the students do the work. But all the marking and all the grading has no impact whatsoever. And this is one of the things that teachers experience as the most stressful things in their workdays. So what I really don't understand is why the implementation of correcting mistakes has not started yet, because it's just so useless.
Well, but let me counter you there, Ben, by saying you must mark students' work. And teachers say, if I don't mark and grade their work, I don't understand how they're thinking. And I want, as you've done, I want to contest that. But the excitement is, the biggest change in my life is artificial intelligence, for the better and for the worse. And so we need to get it right, and we're not there yet. But the notion of using those technologies to do a lot of the grading, commenting, and marking, of course with teacher oversight, is going to make a dramatic difference. Let me raise another one, Ben, and I think this is a fascinating another topic, because when I do the visible learning work, it's the one area that has the least studies, which occupies the greatest time, and that is lesson planning. There are hardly any studies on the quality of lesson plans. Like, let's get real. There's a billion lesson plans out there now. You cannot tell me a single topic that I can't produce 10 or 20 lesson plans instantly using artificial intelligence or using Mrs. Google. But teachers believe they have to create their own. Like, we're doing a lot of work with school-based lesson planning. It's hard work because teachers believe they have to tweak it because they know their class the best. But when I ask them what evidence they have that their lesson worked, they tell me, oh, the students liked it, it was enjoyable, we got through the time. Nothing about impact. And I think this is a debate that we need to have in the academic community as well as in the school community, is how to make lesson plans more effective. And I'm working with some teams at the moment in my own work with the artificial intelligence to not only get that to help create the lesson, obviously by asking all the right questions, obviously by putting in the local curricula, obviously by putting in the rubrics that we want, and getting the students to do the work and feeding back to the teachers what the impact of that lesson plan was, so that the next time they use it, they know how to improve it. That's going to be a dramatic change if it works. But at the moment, the amount of hours that are spent around the world on lesson planning every day is ginormous, without hardly any research whatsoever. I just think that's a fascinating omission.
Yeah, fascinating indeed. So we have talked about corrections, we have talked about lesson planning, and I would like to talk about a third example, and this is actually one that you have mentioned several times, and I was quite surprised by it, to be honest. It's the example of no longer creating differentiated learning objectives and differentiated activity sheets. Why exactly do you think this is something to de-implement?
Yeah. Well, this comes from our work on teacher expectations. And we know that teacher expectations, when teachers have high expectations, they tend to have it for all the students and they're very successful. And sadly, teachers who have low expectations tend to have it for all the students and they're very successful with low outcomes. And then when we go into the classes of those teachers and we look at the differences, the one huge difference is differentiation. The teachers of low expectation think differentiation is different activities for different groups of students. The high expectation teachers say, no, I don't agree. I expect all the students to reach the same success criteria, but I allow different times and different ways to get there. And if they don't get there, I reteach them. Now, when you look up the researchers like Carol Ann Tomlinson, that's what she's been saying for years. It's different times and different ways to get there. And so then when you go to differential success criteria, differential things, you're gone back to grouping. And that kind of grouping is just so nasty. Those kids never catch up. In fact, they even get further apart. Because what often happens is we give them less difficult tasks to do, but no cognitive complexity. Now, if you gave them less difficult tasks with cognitive complexity, I'd be happier. But that's not what happens. And so the problem of having differential success criteria, differentiation in terms of different kinds of grouping, different tasks, is actually doing harm. And so, no, I don't want that. So, yes, we are saying very strongly, have one set of success criteria, one set of lessons, but think of differentiation as different times and different ways to get there. It's much more successful, and it saves you an incredible amount of time with much more impact.
What you just explained sounds very much like the concept of Bloom's master learning to me. Is that what you mean?
Absolutely, yes. It's the same kind of notion, yes, that we expect all the students. But one of the things we often don't do when we do grouping is we don't reteach. We assume if the kids can't get it, it's because they have a deficiency. And that gap between them and the other students actually increases over time. So yes, it is a mastery learning notion.
So one major issue with the implementation is certainly that you need criteria for what can be removed or reduced. And if you want to de-implement certain practices, then you have, of course, you have to make decisions. The medical field has strong evidence for such decisions. They can decide what to de-implement based on randomized controlled trials. We usually can't do this in education because we simply don't have randomized controlled trials. So what is the role of evidence in your view? How can school leaders or teachers make these decisions?
Yeah, look, we have an enormous amount of evidence, and certainly in education, I would be arguing the days of evidence are over. We have so much. It's how we implement quality evidence that matters. And yes, I do use meta-analysis. I do use randomized controls trials. They are harder in education. We can't control the dosage like the medical people can. So it's hard to get equivalent groups. But I absolutely would include many methods. But I think where we're at as a profession is that we have a pretty overwhelming set of data and evidence to show things that truly make the difference compared to those that don't. And what matters most, though, is that school leader, that policymaker, that teacher, about the choosing the high probability interventions, making sure they're implemented with fidelity, but critically, evaluating the impact in your school. How did it make a difference to those students? And I think if we spent a lot more time looking at the evidence of our impact, that would feed into a much healthier situation. So it's not just using all the evidence out there in the research. It's using the evidence in the school. This is why concepts like collective teacher efficacy about their impact is so strong. You're looking at, well, how did it work? And you know, those three impact questions. What did I teach well and what did I not teach well? Who did I teach well and who did I not teach well? And how big was the effect? And we have many of those teachers and leaders in schools at the moment. You must know those teachers who say, when you were a kid, Ben, who said, Ben, I want to understand more about what you were doing here today. I want to understand why you didn't understand this. I want to understand what's going on in your mind. They're kind of nosy. And this notion of evaluative thinking, this notion of how do we make evaluative comments and make decisions and priorities about doing this rather than that, we need to make that as a critical part of our profession. And I'm arguing that it's a fundamental role of school leaders to be nosy, to find out what the impact is, and to do it in a way that is improvement focused, not blame focused. Like, as a teacher, I wasn't successful all the time. That's the nature of the business. But I didn't have someone sitting on my shoulder helping me make decisions to do this and cutting that out. I think we need to be a lot smarter about that.
Well, I basically agree with all of your points, but I think when we talk about evidence in education, we are usually confronted with two objections. Number one is, in my view, effectiveness competes with other criteria in education. It competes with criteria like progressiveness, like modernity, and these criteria are quite arbitrary. So if you try to de-implement something which is not effective and has no impact on learning, there may be people who say, well, yeah, you can't get rid of this because it is progressive. And number two, when you talk about impact and effectiveness, you are often confronted with the accusation of positivism. I think you have been confronted with it many times. Sentences like, you can measure achievement, but is that all that counts? There are certainly other things that are important. So I guess these are two major problems when we want to define something by its impact or its effectiveness. What are your thoughts on this?
Okay, Ben, the criticism that positivism, I'm focused on achievement. Look, I have said so many times, almost in everything I've ever written, achievement is not the only thing we need to be worried about at school. I've done a lot of work, as has of others, looking at, in fact, we're just about to release, with some German colleagues actually, a synthesis of meta-analysis on self-concept. We looked at the syntheses of motivation out there, the syntheses of many other factors besides achievement that are starting to come out in the literature, and I'm delighted about that. I make no excuse, however, for talking about achievement. It is one of the things that we are responsible in schools. I kind of don't know why we would have schools if achievement wasn't in there. I've also argued many times that the biggest predictor of adult health, wealth, and happiness is not achievement at school. It's the number of years of schooling. So how do we make schools inviting places for students to want to come to? And certainly in my most recent work on the sequel, I've talked about school leaders. Their biggest impact on students, yeah, they have an impact on achievement, but it's not as strong as when they are responsible for the culture and climate in every class and across the school. And that culture and climate is about whether it's inviting to come to this class and it's okay to make mistakes, because that's the essence of learning, errors, mistakes. Many classrooms, it's not. Mistakes are seen as embarrassments. Peers aren't very happy when other kids make mistakes. That's not a healthy environment. Now, a school leader can be responsible for that. And so that culture and climate is pretty critical. So yes, no excuse for looking at achievement, but absolutely, my critics are right. There are many other things as well.
So you have mentioned the challenges of the implementation at the beginning, and I think that's the most important thing we have to talk about. There are a lot of challenges. Maybe the most important one has to do with quantity and quality of work. Only a few days ago, I talked to a teacher who has developed a schedule for herself, and it allows her not to work during the school holidays. She said that she works 9.5 hours per workday, avoids idle time between lessons, and has stopped any form of procrastination. So, in other words, she's very efficient, and this allows her to use the school holidays as genuine leisure time. But what really astonished me was that she also told me that she can't tell this to anybody because people would think that she did a poor job. Of course, this is anecdotal, but there's plenty of research evidence that shows the same thing, namely that teachers' work quality is defined by how much they work, how many hours, and so on. And I think somewhere in your book, this is described by the sentence, "Only a busy teacher is a good teacher." And this is a major obstacle to any form of the implementation, because why should teachers get rid of time-consuming low-value practice if the quantity of the work is misinterpreted as quality?
Let me give you another example. In fact, it was my own son when he was teaching in New Zealand. He had 100 kids in the classroom with 3 teachers. And what happened there, they have 3 terms in the school year. For one semester, one of those 3 teachers did all the planning, and the other 2 teachers were told to go home and do nothing. Second semester, a different teacher did the planning for the other 3. And it was enormously successful. But there was one condition that the school principal put on them. They couldn't tell anyone because of what you said. People think a good teacher is a busy teacher. And if you're told to go home and do nothing, you're seen as not as good. That is something we need to seriously contest. And I like what that teacher's doing, the discipline to do that. We also go back to 1954, where Parkinson came up with the claim that work expands to fill the time available. And so what that teacher is saying is, this is my allotted time. I am now going to have to force myself to not only be efficient, I'm going to have to force myself to stop doing some things. Wow. I think that's a very healthy discussion. Now, I hope that she evaluates the choices she makes, that it's in the best interest of maximizing. But I'd have a hunch that if you did this across a larger number of teachers, you would find no difference in the achievement satisfaction of those students. So I think we really do need to have those tough questions, and maybe it's worth trialing in your school for the next 6 weeks. We're going to put a time limit on what you do, but you are going to have to work with us to use that time well. You can't just stop and keep doing the same things you're doing now and stop at a certain moment. You have to say, this is the time, how are we going to make it more productive? I think we could dramatically improve the workload balance. We could dramatically stop the relentlessness if we actually take on some of those studies. So I'm a great fan of it. That teacher needs to stand up and speak more about what's happening and how her thinking has gone. So I bet she doesn't just turn off. I think she probably spends a lot of that time thinking time during the non-busy. But once you sit down to create resources, once you sit down to create lesson plans, there's a lot of busyness goes on that you have to do, you think. But if you haven't a lot of time, and this is my biggest problem, like one government in Australia has already passed legislation for a four-day teaching week. And I'm very, very supportive of that because I don't think we need to be in front of the classes 100% of the time. Like, I have a check for Germany, but Australia has the longest school day and the longest school hours of all the OECD countries. We have twice the amount of time of kids in classes than Finland and Estonia, who we often look up to. We do not have to have that amount of time. We are very, very inefficient. And so it's right back to our original arguments, that it's the implementation is not easy, but it's the right topic if we're going to have a profession and we're going to have professions.
Well, it's so tricky because it's extremely difficult to get rid of these ideas like more is better and quantity is quality.
And busy is good. It's not helping us. It's not productive. It's not in the best interest of the students. And it's not going to create a profession moving ahead. We need to be smarter.
Yeah, sure. But I really ask myself where these notions come from. And I suspect that one factor, at least in Germany, is teacher training. I don't know about Australia, but in Germany, teacher training means 4 or 5 years at university and then usually 2 years in practical training. And these 2 years of practical training are experienced by many young teachers as a very hard time. And research clearly shows this. It's sometimes experienced as kind of a stress test where the only objective is to check if people can work long hours and cope with stress. And I think that's a pretty bad start for a teacher when you begin your training with the notion you have to work a lot. And seldomly people discuss outcomes, impact, or student feedback. It's all not that important, but it's important that you work a lot. So how could a teacher ever get out of this? If the basic message of your initial training is more is better and stress is necessary.
Well, firstly, the effect size of initial teacher education is about 0.08. So it's frighteningly low. However, having been a dean of teacher education in a number of universities, I'm not advocating we stop it. It does have a purpose. It does get rid of a lot of people who learn very quickly that they don't like children. They don't want to be there. We have here in Australia, up to a few years ago, we reviewed teacher education. We saw it as the problem. We had 101 reviews over 15 years. All of them said things like, we need more time, we need less time, we need more practical teachers, we need more academic teachers. You name it, they said it. And they had no effect whatsoever. Teacher education is the biggest cottage industry of the lot. It's the most evidence-free of the lot. So in 2013, the government passed legislation, which I was very supportive of. And I do remind you, Ben, for 10 years, I had a political job in Australia, heading up the government's implementation agency, its quality assurance agency. And I was very supportive of this. And it did one simple thing that dramatically changed to the better. It said, teacher education institutes, we want you to put on the table your evidence that your graduates can affect the learning lives of kids. And so what they found is that they were very good at teaching about feedback, about class management, about control, and about curricula, but they weren't very good at implementing that in the kids, in the graduate students' classrooms. And so over the last 8-10 years since that policy has been introduced, it's dramatically improved the quality of the teacher education experience. We've got a lot more evidence that the employers are very satisfied of it. And we've actually got evidence that the graduates can change the learning lives of kids. It has enormous change. Now, it's being resisted all the time because they want to go back to the old days. So that's the first thing, is that I would be arguing in Germany that the institutions have to do like they ask schools to do. We ask schools to put evidence on the table. They're improving kids' lives. Why aren't we asking the same of the teacher education institutions? Yes, I want them to know about feedback and about class control, but I want them to be able to implement it. But here's my second point. A person here in the US did a review of all the textbooks used in initial teacher education courses across this country. Across all those books, five pages talked about learning. That's what the students are obsessed with. They kind of don't care how you teach. They want to know how to learn. They don't talk about how kids learn. And I think there is another fundamental fault in the system. Now, I know why we focus on teaching. It's a new activity for me when I'm a student teacher. I don't know about class management. I'm terrified of class management. I don't know all the different teaching methods, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so I'm not arguing that you should stop doing that. I want an and, not an or. We need to have a lot more focus on initial teacher education, on teaching and learning. But I want to see that evidence that they actually can change the lives of kids.
And I assume with having that evidence, we could get rid of many things in initial teacher education and maybe de-implement them.
Totally, you can do that. And what's more is the 430-odd programs we have in teacher education has been reduced to 230. They've got smaller in number, and those programs have got larger in size because the inefficiencies in the number of programs we run, again, is a serious problem.
Now, we've talked a lot about the problems of the implementation, and I think this is important to talk about this. But I would also like to know, what is your advice for school leaders who are considering de-implementation as a strategy for their schools? What's your primary advice?
Firstly, as a school community, let's have a discussion on what we consider to de-implement. Like, I'd be horrified, and it probably wouldn't work if I came into your school and said, Ben, I want you to de-implement this. You have to have an agreement. It's the same as when you're doing an implementation. Are we ready for this? So what is your focus? What is the discovery going on? Maybe you need an outside person to come into your school to look at what you're doing to suggest areas of de-implementation that are not having much impact, that you can't see yourself because you've always done it. So the first step is discovery. The first step is agreeing. And agreeing up front what evidence we'd accept to continue not doing it at the end. The second, then, you have to look at a strategy about how you're going to do it. How are we going to do this? Are we going to trial it in some classes first? Are we going to trial it with some teachers? How are we going to do that? And then monitor what happens when we stop doing things. Watching the classes, doing videos of the classes, working with the kids, looking at the impact on their work. And then the final step is that appraisal stage where you say, okay, is this now going to be a scaled up policy across the school? We're no longer going to do this. And so that cycle of discovery, developing a strategy, doing the actual de-implementation, and then appraising is what we're strongly suggesting that teachers do. It's not just coming up with a list and say, we're going to stop this tomorrow. You don't win the hearts and minds of anyone doing that. It has to be a negotiated process. What a better topic for a professional learning community. What a better topic for a collective efficacy to actually have a discussion about what we're going to stop in the school. So when we ask teachers, and we've done this, and Peter DeWitt's done this extensively about what they want to stop, they all say meetings. That's not what we're talking about. Yeah, meetings may not be productive, but it's stopping what we're doing as the day job in the classroom. What we're actually doing in the classroom, in the school, above and beyond meetings, that we can actually scale up.
John, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure talking to you and getting your insights.
Thank you, Ben. Good luck with what you're doing, mate.